Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for the Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is award-winning author Russell W. Eslick. In honor of our veterans and commemorating the 70th anniversary of D-Day, Russell and I will be discussing his latest book, The Aleut Internments of World War II, Islanders Removed from Their Homes by Japan and the United States. Good morning, Russell. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great, Johnny.
Fantastic. Thank you for joining me this morning. It's a pleasure to have you on the air. The Aleut Internments of World War II, Islanders Removed from Their Homes by Japan and United States is a very interesting read. It contains plenty of informative details and facts, so congratulations.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, I grew up in the was born in the last years of the Depression, and I grew up in on a small island off New Jersey, a place called Wildwood. It's a summer resort, so in the winter there were maybe 2,000 people there, and in the summer you'd have maybe 50 or 100,000 people come through. And I quit high school when I was 17 years old, joined the Air Force, and worked on heavy bombers in the, when I was in the Air Force. And after I got out of the Air Force, I went to work for private corporations doing some work for the Air Force and the CIA, the space program, that kind of thing.
That's very interesting. How did you end up working for NASA in the Gemini program?
Well, I was working for a company, and I was getting kind of bored with the job, and an opening came up with a private corporation, and I took it, and they sent me to some rather interesting locations. The first one was Ascension Island, mm-hmm. which is an island down halfway between Brazil and South Africa. And from there, I went to Mexico and the Bahamas, and we were tracking the Apollo spacecraft each time they came over the horizon, and our job was to collect the data and send it on to Houston. So the videos that everybody saw on TV mm-hmm. were the videos that we were recording as the spacecraft passed over us.
That's very interesting, though. I mean, so you were actively involved with the Apollo moon landing then?
Absolutely. In fact, I'll never forget that, July 29th. That was an unbelievable day, and I'm so proud I was a part of history, that I was a very small part of helping to make that happen.
Very interesting. Growing up, were any of your family members in the military at all?
My father had served in the Navy back in the 1920s, mm-hmm. and after I joined the Air Force, my brother joined about 6 months later. But other than that, I mean, I understand I had some relatives in the Civil War that mm-hmm. fought on both sides, and mm-hmm. but other than that, I don't think so.
I see. So did you enjoy the times that you were in the United States Air Force?
Well, at the time, I probably griped as much as any person in the service. But on retrospect, yes, it was some of the best times of my life.
Where were some of the places that you were stationed?
Well, I never got overseas when I was in the mm-hmm. Air Force. I was in Texas, Mississippi, Georgia, California.
Very interesting. Now, you were also involved with the Space Shuttle program, correct?
That's correct. I was in New Mexico, living in New Mexico. I got a job working on the test stands, testing the maneuvering engines for the Space Shuttle. So we got to see the early development of the Space Shuttle.
Very interesting. looking back during your childhood life, did you ever envision the opportunity that you have had at a very young age, I guess in this case, the opportunity to work on the Gemini program involved with the moon landing and then, of course, the space shuttle, basically a shuttle that's sending astronauts in and out of space pretty much quite regularly?
Not at the time. It was growing up, you know, that was in the 50s, mm-hmm, and, you know, that was something that was so far off that nobody even imagined that it would ever happen. And when it did, why, it was just spectacular.
You also mentioned just now you worked for the CIA. What kind of work did you perform for the CIA and the Air Force?
Well, we were involved in a couple of different things. We were, our main job was to track Soviet submarines and underwater nuclear explosions, because mm-hmm. at one time, off the east coast of the United States, every 300 miles, there was a Soviet submarine with missiles pointed at the United States, and our job was to keep track of them.
I see. And, of course, this is during the Cold War.
It was very much during the Cold War, yes. And I that's how I ended up in the Aleutian Islands. So we had a station in the Aleutian Islands, and mm-hmm. so I was there. And the government had had a interesting way of naming these, or interesting names for all these different stations. Our station in Newfoundland was Holy Hattie, and the one in the Aleutians was Sunfish. So they named them after fish.
I see. Very interesting. Now, with all this stuff that you've done, I guess, you know, basically from a technical side of the equation, when did you discover you like to write?
Well, I got into writing a lot different than most people do. Mm-hmm. I was we were living in Florida at the time, and they had a radio show on there, and they wanted you to write an essay on what you would really like to have if you could have something. Well, I had two requests in my letter. I wanted to win $500 to take my wife on the honeymoon she'd never had, and also I wanted $500 for charity, so I won. And I said, well, if I can get $500 for writing a letter like this, why, maybe I can make some money writing books, articles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I took a course in magazine writing, and I turned the assignments into my first book, which was a collection of true stories of the American West.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. So do you use your writing to express yourself or pretty much to entertain others?
I think it's somewhat both. I write for myself, but I also write for a general audience that I feel needs to hear these stories that I write.
Real life, real situation, rather than, say, fiction?
Yeah, I prefer nonfiction, historical nonfiction. And I also look for stories that people have never heard before. They've heard them maybe years ago and forgot about them, something like that. The story of the situation with the Aleut Indians, I have not met anybody that has ever heard that story, even knew that it happened. So this is why I write these kind of stories.
How did you learn about the Aleut people and their plight during the war?
Well, when I was doing my research for a previous book, Shattered Lives, Shattered Dreams, which is the true story of the arrest and internment of German Americans in America, I came across a couple of small items that mentioned it, but there was nothing else. So I contacted the Aleut people in Alaska and talked to them about it, and they sent me over 1,000 pages of documents and a documentary, and I had a lot of encouragement from them to write the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's basically how I got my information.
Very interesting. Why did you decide to write the Aleut internments of World War II?
Well, when I wrote Shattered Lives, Shattered Dreams, I realized that people did not know that story, and they knew even less about this story.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt if I could play some small part in letting people know and keeping it from ever happening again, it will have been a very worthwhile project.
Yeah, yeah. And the inspiration behind the book in terms of wanting to let people know, is this something that you felt like no one else pretty much care about it? I mean, people ignore the situation. And on the other hand, have you received information from other people that said that, well, Russell, it's war. War is tough. Do you buy that?
Absolutely. Absolutely have. A lot of people would just, they have no concept of what happened before.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, people today sometimes can't even remember what happened a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
It comes, it's forgotten. And mm-hmm. I didn't want to let this be forgotten. I wanted people to, in a way, get in their faces and say, look, this is what happened. This is what we did. This is what our government did. Yeah, it was war, and there may have been some necessity for the internment camps in the United States, but there was no necessity for what they did to the Aleut people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. How difficult was the research?
Well, with all of the information provided to me by the Aleut Indians, it wasn't that difficult at all. I just had to go through the material and pick out the most relevant points and expand on them and talk to the people that knew something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And incidentally, there at last count, there were only 3 survivors of the camps in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Everybody else has died off because, you know, they'd all be in their 90s or some of them
right.
in their 100s.
Right,
but,
right.
So there's 3 of them left. And the Aleuts were very happy that I wrote the book because their children had no concept of what their parents and grandparents went through.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a way for the Aleuts to educate their own people on what happened.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Did you discover any unexpected surprises from your research?
Not really. Some things, like the way the Russians treated the natives of Alaska when they owned Alaska, and how it wasn't a whole lot different from the way the Americans treated the Indians when they took over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I did find that one thing that was surprising to me was that there was so much racism going on in Alaska before the war and during the war, and even a little bit after the war. That was kind of a surprise.
I see. Who provided the most research material for you? Did the federal government help at all?
They are very reluctant to provide any information. I got almost nothing from the federal government. Most of what I got came from the Aleut Indians themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They have preserved their documents because there are not a lot of these documents left, and they wanted to keep them for their own records. And so they provided me with what they had, but the federal government, I got very little or nothing from them.
Mm-hmm. But the federal government did not deny any of the things that you found, correct?
Oh, no. They never denied it. In fact, after the war, they had the hearings and everything, and which brought a lot of this out as mm-hmm. to what happened. So, but they still hate to admit that they did anything wrong.
I see. What kind of documents and materials were you provided with?
Well, I was provided with depositions from many of the Aleuts who came back from the camps, who came back from Japan. I was provided with official messages from the War Department to various admirals and generals and that type of thing. And plus, I had received some information that the Japanese government had put out during the war on their version of events while they occupied the Aleutians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. your book is very thorough, and that's the reason why I'm asking that question, because it seems like there were lots of first-hand information from both governments as well as obviously from the that were in the camps.
Well, that information was provided primarily by the Aleut people. That's where most of it came from. If it wasn't for them, that book would have never been written.
I see. Please give us a brief history of the Aleut people. Who are they?
Well, it's my understanding that they originally came from Siberia, and they crossed over the land bridge several thousands of years ago, 10, 12,000 years ago, whatever it was, and they split off into two groups. One group went south through Alaska and down the coast of North America, but the other group, they moved out into the Aleutians. And surprisingly, if you stop to think about the Aleutians, I know a lot of people have never been there. Mm-hmm. I spent 14 months there, so I'm very familiar with it. There are no trees anywhere in the Aleutians. It's called the birthplace of the winds. The wind has been known to blow at 110 miles an hour. When our troops landed on Adak, which is one of the islands there, the wind was blowing at 110 miles an hour. So, you know, the snow and rain, it blows horizontal. But they're totally treeless islands. And so it's kind of strange that they would choose to live in such a hostile environment, mm-hmm. but they not only lived there, but they survived. Now, the Aleutians stretch from the mainland of Alaska 1,100 miles west till they're fairly close to Kamchatka Peninsula, which is part of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very close to China and Japan, mm-hmm. relatively speaking.
Mm-hmm. How did the United States end up with the Aleutian Islands?
They were part of the Alaska Purchase. Back after the Civil War, the Seward convinced the government to buy Alaska for $7.2 million. And the Aleutians, of course, were part of of Alaska. And it was the biggest mistake the Russians ever made, because all the natural resources and everything we have gotten there have just far outweighed what we ever paid for it. And interestingly enough, there are people in Russia now who would like to cancel the sale and take Russia back, or take Alaska back, but that's not going to happen.
I see. One of the interesting things you covered in the book was all this exploration of the Aleutian Islands and Alaska came about because of trade, and in this particular case, the fur trade. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I believe the date was about 1745 that they first discovered the Aleutian Islands. Peter the Great was the ruler of Russia. He was a very enlightened ruler, but the Russian nobility were very greedy and everything, and they were looking for ways to increase their wealth. And they heard that there were islands to the east of Russia which were rich in furs. That was one story. But what really happened was there was explorers had gone there. Bering, which the Bering Sea is named after, had taken a ship there, and he died on the islands. But when the survivors came back, they brought back the most beautiful seal pelts that you could imagine. And the Russians saw this as a way to increase their empire and to increase their wealth. And they said, well, we've got all these Indians there. We'll just use them as slave labor, make them do the hunts. And so that's what they did, and they got rich off the furs, until they almost depleted the entire fur trade in the Aleutians.
In reading your book, one of the things I discovered was the concept of how the Russians were doing their business with the fur business. And, of course, the people that were involved, as I read the book, I realized that it's pretty much the same like what the British did with the East Indies Trading Company.
Right. It really is. It really is.
These people are very powerful people, and of course they are the rich people who basically took advantage of the locals.
Well, that's absolutely true. And one thing about the natives of Alaska, they suffered far worse under the Russians and the Americans than any other indigenous tribe in North America.
I guess because they're out of sight, out of mind from other people.
That's maybe part of it, but I think it was just their nature to enslave mm-hmm. people.
One of the things also I discovered reading the book is that Russia actually had a lot of influence in the northwest area, territory of America for a while.
Yes, they really did, and all the way down to just north of San Francisco, they controlled a lot of that. That was part of the way they were planning on extending their empire, but they eventually pulled out. They got chased out by the British and the Americans. And there's an old thing that says 4440 or fight. That was 4440 was the latitude that they wanted to push the Russians back up north. So there were almost some fights over that.
What caused the Aleut people to be put into internment camps during World War II?
Well, on June 6, 1942, and notice June 6 was also D-Day.
Right.
The Japanese attacked Dutch Harbor, which is one of the little cities in the Aleutians, thinking they could pull off the same surprise attack that they had pulled at Pearl Harbor, but the Navy had broken their codes and knew they were coming and was ready for them. Now, the reason the Japanese attacked the Aleutians was as a decoy. They never really at first intended to occupy it or attack it, but they wanted to catch Halsey's carriers at Midway, so Yamamoto, who was the admiral who led the Pearl Harbor raid, he decided if they could send a decoy fleet to the Aleutians, Halsey would think that the Japanese were invading the Aleutians in prelude to attacking the U.S., and he would send his carriers there. But since the Navy had broken the code, they knew what was going on. And so Halsey sent a fleet up there, but it was a small fleet. And, of course, we won the Battle of Midway, and that stopped the invasion of Australia.
How did the Aleut people end up in the camps then?
Well, when the Japanese attacked, They attacked the island of Kiska and Attu. On Kiska, they took a U.S. weather station with 11 sailors and took them back to Japan. Then they have invaded Attu, and Attu was the westernmost island in the Aleutian chain, and there was a village there with 41 Aleuts and two American school teachers. And they rounded up the village and took them back to Japan. Well, the U.S., when they heard this, they said, well, we've got to protect the Aleuts, so we'll put them in camps in southeastern Alaska. And there was a lot of racism, and there was really no need to move the Aleuts out of Alaska, out of the Aleutians. And what happened was, if you had even one-eighth Indian blood, you were put in the camps with the Aleuts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Japan, 50% of them died, and in the American camps, 10% died.
And basically, these people were not enemy of any state, so to speak.
No, unlike the Japanese and the Germans who were interned in the U.S., there was no national security issue. Mm-hmm. It was merely that they wanted to get them out of the Aleutians, supposedly protect them. But in reality, it came out later that they used some of them for slave labor to gather for the seal harvest.
Can you share some of the horrific stories you discovered while writing the book?
Well, there are quite a few. The camp in Japan was not a true internment camp because the people were not treated as prisoners. Per se, they were, but they weren't, and they had pretty much had the free run of the area they were in. But so many of them died from tuberculosis and from the diet, and the Japanese treated them pretty harshly when they were there. Mm-hmm. And in the American camps, the camps were actually worse in many cases than the POW camps that American servicemen were in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And there was so much racism, and I keep bringing up racism because that was a big part
mm-hmm.
of it.
Mm-hmm.
But they were taken into the camps. The camps were old mining camps and canneries. And the buildings they were put in, the floors were rotted. There was no electricity, no water, no sanitary facilities or anything. And they had to live in conditions that were unbelievable. Some of them were forced to leave their islands. They were given an hour's notice, put on ships, and taken to Southeast Alaska with just the clothes on their back. Then the Navy would go in and burn their villages to make sure that the Japanese couldn't get them. And medical care was almost non-existent. On one of the on the ship, the Delaroff, they were put in the hold, and they were dying off in the hold, and they were unable to get any medical care because the doctor didn't want to go down there and take care of them. And it was just, they were literally prisoners.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Instead of being protected, they were somehow taken prisoners.
Basically, and they were exploited.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in Ketchikan, they were, it was unbelievable the way they were treated in Ketchikan. They were treated like they were lepers, and
mm-hmm.
instead of the people helping them in the camps, they arrested them and treated for alcoholism, tried
mm-hmm.
to say they had venereal disease when they didn't and that they were a threat to the community. And the
mm-hmm.
only help that some of them got were from other Indian tribes living in the area, primarily
mm-hmm.
the Tlingit tribes living in southeastern Alaska.
Interesting. So you mentioned before that Aleut people were very excited about you writing a book about them. How do they feel about you telling their story?
Well, after you have to go back to the time after they got out of the camps.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them, like the Germans, after they were in the camps, did not want to tell their story. They just
yeah.
wanted to forget about it, and they wanted to get on with their lives. But there were a group of them, of younger ones, that said, no, we need to tell a story. So they put together all the documents and everything, and there was a documentary made a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That told their story, but the real story was never told. And so they were very, very happy that I was going to tell their story so that the rest of their people could actually know what happened.
Interesting. So how are the Aleut people doing right now?
Well, when the Russians discovered the Aleutians, there were about 20,000 of them. 20,000 Aleuts.
Mm-hmm.
After the Russians left and the Americans took over, at the start of World War II, there were maybe 2,000 Aleuts left. And after the war, they were able to get some reparations from the government to rebuild their churches and their villages. And they're now doing very, very well. In fact, if you want to take a trip, you know, they have
mm-hmm.
tourism to the Aleutians now, where you can take a cruise ship or you can fly out there for a camping holiday or something like that. But
mm-hmm.
the sad part mm-hmm. is that on a couple of the islands, including Attu, they have never been allowed to return, and they never will be. The government says that they're not going to let them go back there, so they still have not gotten everything back that was taken from them.
What would you like your readers to gain from reading this book?
I would like them to gain an insight into what can happen when a government goes wild for the wrong reasons. What can happen when they take advantage of people who, for no reason other than their own gain, the gain of the people that's abusing them. And I hope I'll enlighten them that these conditions have existed and can continue to exist if we let them happen.
Where can someone go to buy your books, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Okay. The book is available at Barnes & Noble, Walmart.com, Amazon.com. It's on Kindle. I'm not sure about Enoch. Or they can contact the publisher, McFarland Publishers in North Carolina. Or they can ask their library to order it for them.
Wonderful. As an accomplished author with four books and having your recent work, you had mentioned this book before, Shattered Lives and Shattered Dreams, nominated for a Pulitzer. Do you have any advice for aspiring authors?
Absolutely. The first thing I always like to quote is, the first person I always like to quote is Winston Churchill, who said, never, never, never quit. The second thing I would say is just keep writing, and if you want to get it published, you'll find a way. If it's a good story, it'll get published some way or another. I also tell I have people say that self-publishing is a better way to go than having a publisher, and in some cases that's true. Self-publishing is an excellent way to go, but I just say to people, if you want to write, do it. Don't let anybody steal your dream. Get out there and put yourself out there, and don't take rejection personally, because I've got a drawer full of rejections, and everybody gets them, and it's not a personal thing. So I just say, do it. Don't let anybody steal your dream.
That's a wonderful advice that you have for aspiring authors. Coming back to your book that was nominated for Pulitzer, Shattered Lives, Shattered Dreams, that is about World War II as well. So tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. I had known about the German-Americans for quite a long time, but I never found much information on it. And one day I was in church, and our pastor was doing a sermon, and he mentioned the Japanese-Americans. So after the sermon, I said to him, you didn't mention the Italians or the German-Americans. He said, I didn't know about them. And I realized that maybe 1 out of 100 people might know that German Americans and Italians were also in the camps with the Japanese. And so I decided to do some research, and I got in touch with some of the people who had actually been in the camps, and they sent me their stories, which I included in the book. And after the war, before that, let me go back a little bit. The U.S. government decided that they wanted to get the South American governments involved because there were a lot of Nazis in South America. So they convinced the South American government to let them kidnap 4,700 Japanese, German, and Italian citizens from South America with the help of those governments. And they brought them to the United States and put them into camps. And they were using all of these people as bargaining chips with the Nazis to exchange them for Americans that were being held by the Germans. And we did get some of our wounded servicemen back, and we got our diplomats back. But many of the people that they sent to Germany had never, ever lived there. Many of them were American citizens who their only crime was that their ethnicity. Maybe they spoke German, and they may have had a relative in the German army, or maybe one of their neighbors said to the FBI, oh, that guy's a spy. So on December 8th, 3 days before Germany declared war in the U.S., the FBI rounded up 60,000 German-Americans, and many of them ended up in the camps, and many of them ended up going back to Germany where they had never lived. So I had the fortunate experience of visiting with some of the people who had been in the camps as children, and it really was able to put a human face on that book.
Very interesting. Did you do a whole lot of research for that as well?
Yes, I did. That took me about 2.5 years to write, And the Aleut book took me about 3 years to write, research and writing. Because as you can imagine, there's a lot of research that goes into something like this.
Right, right. Why did you decide to write about history? Some of the things that you've written in the past, the award-winning books that you have, are all about history and people.
Well, one of the things that I believe is that one of the reasons we are having so many problems in our country today is because people do not know their history. They don't know the history of their country. It's, they don't teach it in the schools anymore. They just don't. And so people don't understand the sacrifices that were made by the millions of people that came before them, the greatest generation, and what happened in the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, and some of the sacrifices that have been made over the years. And they haven't learned this. So if I can put it out there and let them know, you know, this is what happened in our country, and you should be proud of your country, and you should understand that this is what the country is built on. If I can do that, then I feel I've accomplished something.
Interesting. So what's next for you?
Right now I am working on a book, a collection of war stories. It's little-known war stories and stories of what happened in America during the different wars. It covers several wars from the 1830s up through the Korean War. And there are stories in there that people have never heard before. And so, like, for instance, there's a story in there of Joseph Okolhomby. Now, they talk about Sergeant York, but Joseph Okolhomby, he captured 71 Germans and killed 250 Germans in World War One, and his story has never been told. And so this is the kind of story that I'm including in this book. I just finished a chapter on the Berlin Airlift. And most Americans don't know any of these stories. So if I can let them know, hey, this is our heritage. This is what we're all about. Maybe I'll have, can change things a little bit.
Interesting. You had mentioned to me about your book has been optioned by a publisher in England, correct? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, no, I have three books that I self-published, and this is what I was saying about aspiring authors, go for it. And they're being picked up by a publisher in London. And I have no idea when they're going to get started on them or when they'll be available, but there are three of them that they have picked up.
That's fantastic. Well, what have you learned from doing all this research during World War II and the fate of the Aleuts and the Germans and so forth? What have you learned in terms of, I guess, living and being a human being that you can share with us?
Well, I guess the main thing that I've learned is that if it can happen once, it can happen again, and we have to do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again. It doesn't matter race, creed, or anything. We just cannot let this kind of thing happen again. We have to, as Americans, as human beings, have to put a stop to it.
Looking back at your wonderful life in terms of being involved with the space program and so forth, is there any particular moment in time that you were basically, I mean, it just was phenomenal for you?
I would have to say the moon landing, when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon. For me, that is one of the highlights of my life, that I was able to be a small part of that great history.
That's wonderful. Russell, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Well, absolutely. Too many people are concerned about material things and money and things like that, and they place those first. And my motto is God first, then family, then people, then things.
Wonderful. And how have you lived your life from that perspective?
Well, I've tried to be very honest. I've tried to be a good person. I've tried to care about other people, but sometimes I fail, and I'm not very happy with myself when I fail, but I'd like to think that the good I've done far outweighs the times that I've failed. But being human, mm-hmm. I'm going to fail. And I haven't always been the best husband or father I could be, but I keep working on that and hoping that I will be someday.
Spoken from a wise human being, I could tell you that. So it's been wonderful to have known you all the years as well. I mean, we met about a couple of years ago.
About 3 years ago, I believe it was.
That's right. In Utah, when I did a keynote speech at the Writers' Conference there, and I didn't realize at that time that I'm meeting someone who is very, very special in terms of the depth of knowledge that you have about life, living, and most importantly, wanting to make a positive difference in our global community. So for that, sir, I really congratulate you for all the work you have done. And I'm looking forward for the work that you're going to continue to do to make a positive difference in our global community. Do you have any particular things that you are seeing right now that's happening around us that probably are heading in the wrong direction that needs to be corrected?
Well, as a disabled veteran, one of mm-hmm. the big things for me is what's going on in the veterans, the VA system. And mm-hmm. I am very upset with about the release of the five terrorists for mm-hmm. Sergeant Bergdahl. I mean, we needed to get him back, and we should have gotten him back, but I just don't think that that was the way to do it. And I'm very upset, as an American citizen, I'm very upset and I'm very worried what these guys are going to do once they get back on the battlefield.
How about the situation in terms of the Veterans Administration itself, in terms of addressing the issues that the current veterans are facing with regards to their medical situations?
Well, there were, I heard this morning, there were 57,000 veterans who are waiting more than 90 days to get their to be able to see a doctor. I've known veterans who have applied for disability. One friend of mine, it took him almost 8 years to get his disability, and he was wounded in Korea. So these are the kind of things that are really upsetting me when there is no need for it. They one solution that's been put forward is that they allow us to go to a civilian doctor when mm-hmm. we need to. Mm-hmm. In my case, I live in St. George, which is 2 hours north of Las Vegas. I have to drive to Las Vegas to see my doctor. To either that or drive to Salt Lake City, which is 5.5 hours away. So even though we have a VA clinic here, mm-hmm. if I want to see my primary care doctor, I either have to go to Vegas or to Salt Lake City, and it shouldn't be that way. I should be able to walk into any doctor that I need to see, and so should any other veteran, and be taken care of without worrying about waiting long times to see a doctor.
I would think that will actually be cheaper, don't you think?
It would be. It absolutely would be cheaper because the government spends a lot of money on the veterans, okay, mm-hmm. and rightly mm-hmm. so. But I think they could really reduce the cost if they allowed us to go to, you know, a civilian doctor.
And again, this is not about the Democrats or the Republicans. This is just this is a systemic problem.
Right. It's a matter of greed. It's what I was talking about earlier, where people put mm-hmm. money ahead of people.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that were running these the VA facilities, they were getting bonuses for short wait times for the veterans, when in fact there were no wait times. Sometimes they were long wait times, is what I mean to say, where some of the mm-hmm. veterans have already died because they couldn't get treatment. And these guys and gals are getting these bonuses for saying that, hey, we don't have any long wait times. So to me, that's criminal, and that's what I was talking about, putting money before people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So much so. Any last words about the Aleut internment of World War II book?
Well, I think I've pretty much said it all in that book, and Well, that's what I'll say. I think I've pretty much said it all. It's all been said.
It is a wonderful book. I've truly enjoyed reading the book. I recommend it for everyone to get a copy of it. It has lots of history in it. It has some wonderful history about Alaska, about the gold rush, about how the Russians were actually in the United States back in the early 1800s and 1700s in some ways, I guess. And overall, you're right in terms of history sometimes do repeat itself if we're not careful.
Well, that's true, and that is a statement that is probably one of the truest statements that's ever been made about history, that history repeats itself and we never learn from it. And I think that's been proven over and over again. And incidentally, when I finish my new book, I'll be sending you a copy, Johnny.
Well, I appreciate it very much. I look forward to reading that because you do have some wonderful, interesting insights about things that I think we all need to know about the past, because it does give us an opportunity to guide us going forward in making the right decisions about our life, our community, and about our future.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, and I'm going to keep working at these kinds of stories. I'm looking now for another story that I can put into a book that's mm-hmm. similar to this one and the Shattered Lives book, because I think there's so much out there that nobody that has been forgotten or never told.
Right.
So
right.
And it needs to be.
So true. Well, Russell, thank you for the great recipe for living that you've shared with us just now and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be author, physicist, and futurist Luis Del Monte. For more than 30 years, Luis was a leader in the development of microelectronics for IBM and Honeywell. Luis and I will be discussing his latest book, The Artificial Intelligence Revolution. Will an artificial intelligence robot be a friend or foe? For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Russell, thank you again and have a blessed day.
My pleasure, and thank you for the interview.
Thank you. Bye-bye.